Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Marriage, then children. It's a progression that most Americans have followed, and for much of America, the educated, middle, and upper class, that's still a common tale. But a new study tells a different story. Over half of all births to women under 30 are out of wedlock. It's a trend that's booming in low-income, low-education crowds, but one that hits home for all of us. This hour on Point, a rise in young, unmarried mothers and what it means for America. I'd like to give a special welcome before we begin today to our newest listeners on WNSC in Rock Hill, South Carolina. We're glad you're with us, and we look forward to taking your questions and your calls. So to our topic at hand, joining me first in studio is Andrew Sum, professor of economics and director of the Center for Labor Market Studies at Northeastern University. He's lead author in a new study on young families, young children, and our economic future. It comes out this fall. Andrew, great to have you with us.
Thank you very much, Jane.
So 50% of all births to women under 30 are now out of wedlock. What's the significance of those numbers?
Well, Jane, actually, the high share of births to young women have been taking out of wedlock is a phenomenon that's been going on for the last 45 years. Part of the reason why I think it's not viewed as a major story is the fact that every year it has kept going up. There's no sudden surge in these numbers. But the main reasons why we ought to be caring a great deal about this, particularly in a presidential election year, is that these share of births out of wedlock have placed an extraordinarily high share of the nation's young families at economic risk. The average real income of our young families has declined considerably over the last three decades. The growth in economic disparities between our most affluent and least affluent young families is at an all-time record high. The gaps in income for families that are starting out in life, who should be starting off on a more even keel, are just substantially divergent. The third thing is that these changes in family structure have substantial effects on their children, and the effects on these children will have long-term intergenerational effects on our ability to raise an adequate workforce, a well-educated workforce, a productive workforce, and population that is capable of engaging in adequate social and civic behavior. And last thing, Jane, very quickly, is it also has enormous fiscal consequences for our national, state, and local governments.
So we'll get into all of this. I want to break down the numbers first. Tell us how education plays into this.
Education plays an extremely powerful role. The share of births to young women out of wedlock varies from a low of 10 to 15% among those women that have a master's or higher degree, to a high of 70% for those that have not graduated from high school. Failure to graduate from high school is one of the greatest risk factors for being a single mother, and that risk factor has grown substantially over time, partly due to the fact, Jane, that their potential husbands, the men with limited schooling, face all-time 35-year lows in their earnings. A large part of our research has been focused on exactly that issue of where are the men.
We'll get to that also. There's so many things to talk about here. I want to break down the categories, though. Poverty. How does poverty play into the statistics?
Poverty is both a factor that it contributes to out-of-wedlock childbearing, but also generates the next future generation of poor youth.
So it's a cycle.
It is a cycle that one of our guests today is a true expert on and has written some very provocative research. I'll let Sarah comment on that in greater detail. But the answer is that, yes, poverty circumstances contribute substantially to being married out of wedlock, and then having a child out of wedlock substantially increases the likelihood that that family will be raised in poverty.
How do the numbers break along racial and ethnic lines?
Along racial and ethnic lines, there remain some important differences. But the key thing I would say, Jane, is that these rates of out-of-wedlock birth have been rising across the board for whites, Hispanics, and Asians. But overall, in 2006, which is our last year of comprehensive data, about a quarter of all births to Asian women were out of wedlock, versus somewhat over 40% to white women, over half of Hispanics, and close to 80% to black women.
The economics of this, in your study, you say this: declining economic fortunes of young men without college degrees underlie the rise in the out-of-wedlock childbearing, and they create a new demographic nightmare for this nation. Can you describe that? What are we in for?
Well, Jane, if you look at marriage rates among men at a given point in time and try to just build a model to predict who will be married, what you find is that in a study I just finished for you last night on this, is what you do find is that earnings remain the single best predictor of which men 22 to 32 will be married. And this is true even when you take into account such factors as the educational attainment of these young men. Now, it is true in the social sciences, we like to say correlation is not causation. But at the same time, Jane, there's been a study recently completed by Manpower Demonstration Research Corporation on this Career Academies program, where we invested time and effort in preparing young men and women for jobs and post-secondary ed. It's one of the few programs we found where we get large, significant earnings gains for men, and those gains in earnings were accompanied by a 12% improvement in their marriage rate. So if we're beginning to look for evidence that says it's more than correlation, this finding from this recent release study provides powerful evidence that if we could find a way to improve the real earnings of young men, more of those young men will, in fact, take those earnings and end up being married and living with the mothers of their children. And I think that's a very powerful finding that did not get the publicity it deserved last week.
Andrew Sum, hold on just a moment. I'd like to bring Sarah McClanahan into the conversation. She's in New York. She's professor of sociology and the director of Center for Research on Child Well-Being at Princeton University. She's the lead investigator in an ongoing study on fragile families and the well-being of children. Sarah, thanks for joining us.
Hello. Thank you.
So what do you make of these numbers, some of which we've just heard? 50% of all births to women under 30 are now out of wedlock.
So I guess I pretty much agree with what Andrew has said. These trends have been going on for a long time, since the late 60s and 70s. So there's nothing really new in terms of the trends. And the other really big part of this is it's a phenomena of low-educated mothers and fathers. So it's not as though this trend is equally affecting all children and all families.
And the economics of this, it sounds like that's the core problem. The economic implications, the consequences for these children are dire, especially in the first 5 years. Is that not correct?
Well, that's what we're trying to demonstrate. We're trying to figure out if that's the case and show it. The issue is also, as Andrew mentioned, is some people will argue it's not really the family structure itself that contributes anything in addition to just the fact that these are low-income parents. But I personally believe that the family structure and these changes in the family are exacerbating the consequences of low income for the children in the future.
You documented in your report a lot of multi-partnered fertility, as you call it. Can you describe that, and what did you find?
Yeah, so that's just one of the ways in which this new family formation pattern is contributing to sort of more problems independent of just the income. So one thing that you see is these women start having children, not so much teen. Teen pregnancy has been going down, except maybe in the last couple of years. But what you see is these women start having children at 20 or 21, and then the relationship breaks up. Actually, at the time, they're hoping that they will get married to their partners. They have high expectations. But the relationship ends, and then they repartner with someone else and have a child with that person. Now, but they've also got this other child in the household, and that's what we refer to as multi-partner fertility. And it's kind of like when in the old days you had a divorce and then a remarriage and you brought a child from another household into the new relationship. And the researchers have found that that makes things more complicated. It's just harder to deal with the family when there's more fathers involved. And so if you imagine doing sort of doubling that, so some of these mothers will have two or more children in the household with different fathers. So that's just very time-consuming, working out all the arrangements. It's hard enough to get child support from one man or set up visitation with one father. Now you've got to be doing it for two or possibly three different fathers. And also, the multi-partner fertility I think contributes to jealousy and distrust among the couple. We can talk about that later if you want. But there's quite a bit of evidence in qualitative research that when the, say, a mother has a new partner, and when that partner goes to visit his child in another household, he's also seeing the mother, and this is a mother who was a former partner. That creates jealousy.
Complicated family relationships and dynamics. Yeah. Before the break, I want to go back to Professor Sum here and have you tell us what the consequences, to your mind, based on your research, for these children socially, economically, in the first 5 years.
Well, Jane, following up on what Sarah had said, the fact that we have such a larger share of children being raised in these single-parent families, as I said at the beginning, has created this enormous gulf income-wise in the economic well-being of these families. I mean, you have families in the top 20% of young families with an average income that is 17 times as high as those in the bottom 20%. And these are families, what I said, is starting off on the basic first steps in life, where you would think they would be starting off on a much more, you know, even line. What happens, though, after that is not, so you also have then a much larger share of these children being raised in poverty or near poverty. Nearly two-thirds of the children in these young single mother families where the mother doesn't have a diploma are poor, near poor. And that then leads to all of these social, educational, and health problems that create the next generational problem.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about young, unmarried women with children. You can join the conversation. What do you think is driving these unmarried parenthood situations? Lack of jobs, stronger women, the Juno effect, as it's called. Andrew Sum is with us. He's lead author on the new study about young families and the economy. Also with us is Sarah McClanahan, sociologist and lead investigator in an ongoing study on fragile families. Sarah McClanahan, talk about the effects more broadly and socially related to crime and crime statistics in our country.
Well, one thing that's pretty clear is that the increase in incarceration that's been going on, the incarceration of young men since 1980, has probably contributed somewhat to this increase in non-marital childbearing. We found in our study that that almost half of all the young unmarried fathers had spent some time in jail or prison before the time of the birth when we started the study. This is an astounding figure. And as most people know, the incarceration rates have gone up enormously in the U.S. since 1980. And we also know that when young men are incarcerated, when they come out, they have much more trouble finding a job. So the experience of being incarcerated lowers their earnings, makes them less marriageable in that sense. It also makes it impossible for them to live with the mother of their child in public housing. A lot of public housing doesn't allow a man who's been in prison to live there. So I think the prison policies have been very destructive to the families of these very low-income people.
Professor Sum, another reason to really care about this and be concerned about this statistic is the educational outlook for a lot of these children who grow up in circumstances well beyond their control, single parenthood families. What are they?
Well, the educational consequences are really quite substantial and critical. The recent evidence on this from a series of studies have shown that the likelihood that young people will both graduate from high school and go on to college is significantly affected by the income levels of those families and by the wealth of those families. And in fact, recent studies suggest that income has become more important over time in generating those outcomes, not less important. That living with mother and father also contributes independently to achieving those desirable educational outcomes. And that the educational attainment of the mother and father and the skill levels of the academic skill levels of the mother are very powerful determinants of the cognitive scores of these children, which also influences their likelihood of completing high school, going and completing college. So what we're doing is placing children at tremendously great risk of educational failure, both in high schools and their inability to complete and attend college. And therefore, we can well end up with a less educated, less skilled workforce in the future that will place our economic competitiveness at great jeopardy.
I'd like to bring another voice now into our conversation. Carmen Patterson Worrell joins us now. She is from the Brooklyn Perinatal Network in New York. She's a caseworker and a volunteer coordinator for the Birthing Project, Sister Friend. It's a program that pairs pregnant women with community mentors. Carmen, so glad that you're with us today.
Hi, hello, how are you?
Thank you. What is the biggest challenge that you see these single mothers facing today?
Well, definitely, I would say housing, immigration, and lack of education.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That all stems from, you know, it goes back to when we talk about the lack of education and things that they are not aware of. And it's just like so much like my caseload here. I have 36 women.
Mm-hmm.
Not of the 36 women, I believe five of them are together with their partner. Mm-hmm. However, two out of the five are married.
Hmm.
And we're finding that it has to do with immigration. It has also to do with when you talk about a lack of knowledge. You know, it's like some of them are coming from other countries and with hopes and dreams, believing that their partner is going to make a difference for them, and they really don't. They just pretty much leave them.
So they come here with high hopes. They come here thinking that life is going to be better. Perhaps they'll get married. So they don't. These pregnancies are not planned. These women have a different outlook for their lives than what they've got.
Yes. Yes. Definitely. And most of them are from men who have already been here within the States for a period of time.
What about the fathers of these children, Carmen? Where are they? What are they doing? You say two of the five are married, five are together, but of those 36, the majority, are they
single?
And there's no interaction?
No. And, you know, I talked to some of them, and because, you know, we don't want to really get too personal, but I do have talks with them. And a lot of them say that when they do get a chance to speak to the baby father, most of their responses are that they feel like they don't have the means, so they prefer not to be in the relationship at all, as opposed to being there and not being able to offer them anything. So they think that it's easier or better. I don't want to say easier, but I think that they think that it's better that they're not there at all.
What do you see the cycle repeating in these families, Carmen? Do you see these women with young children then having young children again themselves as they move forward?
Yes, yes, and it a lot of times it's from the same baby's father, and because once again they come in and they speak and talk to them about things that could probably or possibly happen between them two, and 9 out of 10 times it's because the woman has gotten on their feet. They have gotten better. They either attend school or they have found a job placement. And so they feel like it's hope, but then it turns out to go right back to the same, you know, from the beginning again. And then they find themselves not with one but two kids.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Carmen, let me bring a listener into our conversation here. Patty is on the line from Albany, New York. Patty, welcome.
Yeah, hi. I've worked 15 years with young mothers and such in two different cities, and in that 15 years, I have never seen a father want to get married to the kid. Actually, I've seen one in all of the kids that I've had. And in your conversation, I know that correlation and causation do not go hand in hand, and there seems to be no discussion of values in this. We live in a society where we have anything goes family values,
mm-hmm.
and it's very much reflected in the inner city communities. I really believe they are the canaries in the cave, in the inner cities, and they reflect what is to come. They mirror a lot of the values, our declining values.
Mm. Patty, it's a great question. Sarah McClanahan, let me ask it to you first. What about it? There used to be shame and outrage attached to out of wedlock births. And now, you know, it's very different. Is there a shift? Is there a changing attitude among these young women, a glamorization somehow of single motherhood?
Well, I think there has been some shift in attitudes, sort of the sexual revolution in the 60s, and then the birth control revolution, I think, did shift the idea that it was really women's responsibility to not get pregnant, and so there were fewer shotgun marriages after that. But in the study that we did, we interviewed 3,600 unmarried mothers and fathers right after the birth of their child. And a very large percent of them were romantically involved, 80% at the time. Almost 80% of the unmarried fathers came to the hospital to see the child. Hmm. And these parents, a large percent of them wanted to get married. They had plans to get married. And the fathers were just as traditional as the mothers in terms of responding to questions about getting married. They also thought that it was better for a child to be raised by two parents than one parent. So in that sense, their values were not that different from the values of married parents, new married parents. One thing that is different is that people have the sense that a single mother can manage alone. So it's not as though it's the ideal situation, but given that you have a child or you become pregnant and the man leaves, there is a sense the woman can do it. She doesn't need to give up the child, for example.
What do you think, Professor Sohm? Is there a link somehow between the media messages that young women are receiving, or is this a totally different problem, totally different issue?
Well, Jan, just say two things. One is in Sarah's, one of her recent studies, she also shows that there are some differences in single mothers' lower levels of trust in men in general that they could be trusted on, which I think is a factor here. And there's also a sense that even though they did strongly believe in marriage, I think one of the other important things was that they had a much lower expectation that it would be followed by a successful marriage, and it was not followed by that. But at the same time, I would say that I'm still impressed by the body of evidence that shows that when more of these men are put in a position where they could actually achieve higher employment and higher earnings, that they're more likely to take the right types of steps. So I believe that
when they're given a chance, they actually step up.
I believe both values and economics both matter here, and that we need to work on both of them. And I would admit, though, with our first caller, that the media has done a very terrible job, both the television media and the movie media, on perpetuating an image of men, which is anti-marriage, anti-intellectual, and anti-responsibility.
Another call now from Worcester, Massachusetts. Albert is on the line waiting. Welcome to you, Albert.
Thank you, Jane and company. I also don't believe in values. I think the facts are important, and I'd like to mention a few ideas. But I do think that media promulgate an idea of romance that's, you know, impossibly unrealistic. My main point I want to make, though, kind of relates to that. I think that relationships, that intimate, that personal, as a husband and wife are hard. I'm an autistic adult, and I know how hard relationships are. It's just like what they said about the men, that they felt if they couldn't contribute financially, they couldn't give their all. That also relates to social biology. We feel in our genes, we fit in our blood. The man should be the provider. The woman should be the caretaker. Well, as can't think of her name, feminist author said on the show in the past year, you don't have to have men rallying the wagon train around. Susan Fallucci. You don't have to. Women can contribute to being strong and independent. And I think that women feel they have permission now to have babies by themselves. Women are empowered. Hillary almost got nominated president, and she had enough ovarian fortitude. She wasn't going to let go of that possibility.
All right, Albert, I appreciate your call. Thank you. I want to turn back to Carmen Patterson-Worrell, who's back in New York at the Brooklyn Perinatal Network. Carmen, what are you telling these women, your sisters, as you call them, about the future with their children?
Well, I just really try to encourage them and refer them to a lot of places in which that can be assistance to them. Some of them want to go back to school, and we have workshops here, parenting workshops here that we offer to them. And with those classes, we try to really empower them, you know, to go back. And just because you do have this, you have a baby and you're single, that you can still make it. There are still chances out there, and you can still, and we just really try to empower them and encourage them to continue on in life and let this be a barrier or a way to not have them to succeed in life.
Well, good luck to you. I appreciate your work and your time today. Carmen Patterson-Worrell from the Birthing Project, Sister Friend in Brooklyn, New York. I'd like to welcome now Lisa Ward. She's the mother of a one-year-old son, Tyler, and a six-year-old daughter, Tamia. Single mom, raising these kids on her own. Lisa, I appreciate you joining us today, and thank you so much.
You're welcome.
So, Lisa, I wondered if you'd give us a sense what it's like for you day-to-day raising these little ones on your own. I know one child is with your former partner in Barbados, but you have a one-year-old that you're doing it all by yourself. What's it like for you?
It's a challenge, but, I mean, I think it's all about putting your mind to it. And as Carmen said before, being a single parent is not the end of the world. But, I mean, I try really hard and make it work for me, but it is struggling at the same time, you know, trying to do the laundry with the baby. I have no car. So I'm with a laundry bag, with a stroller. I do food shopping with the baby. Everything is done with the baby. You know, at night when he gets up, I'm the only one to be there for him. But I have to, and I want to be a good example for him and make him as happy as any child that have both parents.
Did you plan to get pregnant so young, Lisa? You had your first baby, what, about 18, and your second baby at 23. Was this something that you wanted or expected so early?
Well, when I was 17, no, that's not what I expected, but, you know, things happened. But when I was in Barbados, it was easier because I had my parents there, I had family. It was a breeze to me, as I would say, because my parents were basically raising my daughter for me.
Mm-hmm.
But I came here, it was just me by myself, and, you know, like any other girl, fell in love and thought it was going to work, thought that you were going to get married, and it did not turn out the way that I thought it was.
What do you worry about most for your children as you raise them alone, especially with the son that's with you?
Okay, I don't want my son to think that it's okay to, you know, have kids and don't take care of them. I don't want him to see that. I just want him to have, you know, I try to raise him the best way that I can. That's what I'm scared about. I'm scared that I wouldn't be able to show him right from wrong, or I'm not a male. Sometimes I wonder if I'm doing the best. I can't show him how to be a man. That's how I feel sometimes. But I try my best to teach him right from wrong, try to be a good example to him, and hopefully he will follow.
Do you wish things were different?
Yes, I do. I wish things were different. You know, like, as I said, I thought that me and his father would be together. We were together like 3 years, and then after, he just left, just disappeared. I wish it was different. I wish he had a father, someone, you know, that could do stuff with him like any regular father would want to.
Where do you see yourself, Lisa, in 5 years, in 10 years? Do you hope for, I know you're working hard, you're trying, you're doing your best.
Yeah.
What do you see for yourself 10 years down the road?
Well, 10 years down the road, I'm in school now. I do college online. So 5-10 years down the road, I definitely know I will have a better job or a career, I should say. And I could see myself doing more for my kids financially. And sometimes, you know, when things are not that good financially, you tend to take stress out on your kids, which is not a good thing. I used to do it before, honestly, but now, you know, I try to be more calm. It's not their fault. They didn't ask to be here. So 5-10 years down the road, I could see myself being more relaxed, more financially stable.
Well, we wish you all the best, Lisa Ward, mother of a one-year-old little boy and six-year-old girl. All the best. Take care.
Thank you.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about new research that shows over half of all mothers under 30 are unmarried at the time of birth. Andrew Sum and Sarah McClanahan are with me today. They study young families and their rise in unwed births. I want to get to the phones, but I was just struck by the courage, Professor Sum, that it took for that single mom to come on and talk about what she was going through. What did you hear in her story? What did you hear in her circumstance?
Well, I think there are two things, Jane. One is the fact that one has really strong expectations and hopes that that situations will in fact work out that oftentimes tend to be frustrated, denied. But secondly is that the young woman is doing the types of things that research has shown, one of my colleagues, Nita Fogg, has shown, that those young mothers who become teen mothers but do four things, make sure you graduate from high school, acquire a strong base of academic skills, get steady work experience, and avoid an early second child, are the ones that are most successful in transitioning into a solid middle-class life, and it also increases the likelihood that they will be married as well. Mm. So she is really trying to do all the things that can make a difference.
Let's go to the phones now. Shirley is calling from Algona, Iowa. Shirley, welcome.
Thank you. I teach at an alternative high school in the middle of Iowa, and I have several girls and actually some young men that become parents during the year. These students are what I call floaters. They go from home to home. They do not have a very good home to return to in the evening, and they end up looking for love, and this is the way I see it anyway, and then they end up having children. How do you get these children back into a home where parents, you know, aren't drug addicts, they're not, doing things they shouldn't be doing, and trying to give a moral or some type of help to these students? It is very frustrating because I can't really help them.
Shirley, thanks so much. Sarah McClanahan, you know, this goes to the point of instability in these young people's lives and really the bigger picture, the changing fabric of the family, generally speaking, you know, with over half of all marriages ending in divorce and now half of all births to women under 30 out of wedlock. I mean, what's the future of the American family, generally speaking?
Well, I think that in terms of her comment, you know, she's focusing a lot on children in high school. And I think one point that's very important to make here is the majority of the non-marital births are not to teenage women.
In fact, teen pregnancies are going down.
They are. And so we have to deal beyond with just what's going on with the teenage woman. So it's really a kind of delay in marriage and increase in non-marital childbearing among women in their 20s. So they've finished school to the extent that they're probably not in a high school anymore. And so the question is, you know, what can we do to make them sort of delay having the children and investing more in their education and in their careers? And I think the Lisa, your speaker, really, as Andrew said, was a wonderful example of kind of what a single mother can do. In her case, one other thing that's very interesting is that she has had two children, but they both have been with the same man. So it sounds as though she has a fairly stable home. And another big problem with the non-marital childbearing, in addition to the multi-partnered fertility we talked a little bit about, is that these households are very unstable. There's lots of partnership transitions going on. Mm-hmm. So they're men moving in and out, or sometimes they're just dating relationships. And I think the instability of these relationships makes it very difficult for the mother to raise her child.
On that note, I actually want to turn to the politics of this, because in a Father's Day speech, presidential candidate Barack Obama told fathers to stand up and raise their children. I want to listen to a clip of that speech. Here he is speaking at the Apostolic Church of God in Chicago.
We need families to raise our children. We need fathers to recognize that responsibility doesn't just end at conception. That doesn't just make you a father. What makes you a man is not the ability to have a child. Any fool can have a child. That doesn't make you a father. It's the courage to raise a child that makes you a father.
Andrew, what are the good government policies needed to be put into place? What are the diagnostics here to help address these issues?
Gene, I wish there were a set of simple answers. I would say this, that very quickly, I think Barack's message was the right message at the right time, and I hope that that message does not get confined to Father's Day, but becomes a fundamental debating issue in the campaign, that this country discuss this issue because it needs to be discussed. I would say that there is a whole set of economic issues that need to be taken into account. As a country, because of our economic policies, we have basically destroyed the old working class. The working class that was destroyed is now yielding these large numbers of men who cannot make adequate earnings and incomes to support families. We've got to go back to the, what I consider to be the root of the problem, which is about working on both values, but working on economics. Strong employment, strong earnings, strong education and training, particularly for all of our young men who have experienced enormous earnings losses, but at the same time not give up on the moral campaign. Last thing I would say, Jane, here is there was a wonderful line in the movie Pursuit of Happiness where Will Smith at the beginning of that movie says, "I never met my father until I was 28, and I decided then and there that if I had any children, they would know who their father was." And what we need is a million Will Smiths.
Back to the phones now. Cody is in Malden, Massachusetts. Cody, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thanks.
You're welcome.
I'm actually a single father, I guess. I'm not married to my daughter's mom. Mm-hmm. My daughter's one.
Mm-hmm.
And she has also another son who's seven by another father who she had when she was 18 or 19.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have to say, you had a caller earlier who said, you know, don't take it out on your kids if you get mad financially. But I think that also applies to even if you don't want to be together, even if you don't want to be with the mother of your child, you still need to step up and take care of your child. They deserve to have a father there. And the mother deserves to have some kind of, you know, to be able to go back to school and to be able to have some kind of a life. And you can do that if you're by yourself, but it's insanely hard. Even if you're just there for your children, it's easier for her to do something with herself and better herself.
Was it important to you? Let me ask you, Cody, was it important to you to have some sort of long-term bond? You never married the mother of your girlfriend. Did you worry about some sort of implication for your children down the road?
I did. I worried more that they wouldn't, I think I worried most of that she wouldn't know who I was because it's important to me, even though I don't want to be with her mother, it's very important to me that I'm part of her life. I felt that in the end we weren't together because I felt that it would be better to have her have us not be married and know that we loved her rather than to have us be married and possibly grow up in like an angry household.
Well, Cody, thanks for your call. I appreciate it very much. I want to go to another listener who's in Somerville, Massachusetts. This time Lisa is on the line. Hi, Lisa. Welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
And all due respect to Cody, because he sounds like he's doing the right thing. There isn't a lot of pressure for men to do the right thing, either from their families or from society. And I'd say that's global, because I have a 21-month-old daughter, and she was born in London, and her father's English, and there was no pressure there. And, you know, you don't hear about, like, hordes of men that are just trying desperately to be of some kind of support to their children, be it economic or emotional or provisional. And, you know, it's like I understand we live in a country where it's difficult, you know, for families that are married. You know, there's not a lot of support as far as, you know, daycare or, you know, time off.
What's the hardest part for you, Lisa?
Well, right now I came home from London because my mom is very ill, so I'm taking care of her and my daughter, so, and the house. So it's just I don't have a lot of patience as a person in general, so I definitely struggle with being patient for my daughter. I mean, I'm a bit older. Like, I'm 31 now, so, you know, and I've got a good amount of education behind me. I've done some travel. You know, I'm definitely in a better place where I know I'll be able to bounce back and to provide for my daughter and to provide for her. But I think it's difficult because, you know, what is she not going to get?
Well, I wish you the best of luck. Sounds like you're in a better spot than a lot of women. But what to her point, to Lisa's point, Sarah McClanahan, a lot of pressure. She says there's not a lot of pressure on men to do the right thing, to get married. What do you say to that?
I think that's probably true.
Mm-hmm.
I was also struck by Cody's sort of talking about his fear that his daughter would never get to know him. And I think one thing is that our policies that we've had towards single mothers have, and to some degree, pushed men out. I mean, a lot of the policies that we have are very highly income tested. So if the single mother wants to get some welfare, or sometimes if she wants to get Medicaid or some benefit for her children, or public housing would be another one, she really can't qualify if she were living with the father or married to the father, because his income would be counted and they would no longer be eligible for the benefits. So I think if you really go back to the early policies for single mothers, a lot of them were kind of built on the idea that these were widowed mothers and the father was completely gone. So they didn't have to worry about whether the policies pushed the father out. And of course, since 1960 and forward, the majority of single mothers are not widows. They're first divorced, more recently never married. But I do think that we have to look at our policies again and make sure that we're not, for a low-income couple who are really struggling, we have to make sure that that couple is not better off if the father is not around.
Let's go back to another call now for in Waterbury, Vermont. Lee is on the line. Welcome, Lee, to On Point.
Thank you. That was pretty much my point, is that right now it seems that the incentives exist for having children out of wedlock as opposed to not having children. There are very few incentives for being married, and as some of the people have pointed out throughout the show, one of the huge factors is education and lack of education. But as a single mother, getting to the education and having the child care in place is just incredibly expensive. And the incentives in the child care system are just inadequate. The entire child care system is broken.
Lee, thank you. I'm just running out of time. Let me turn to Professor Sum on that point. Are the incentives flipped? Are they in the wrong places? I mean, what are the real solutions here as far as government programs?
I would agree pretty much with what Sarah had said. Just add three additional items. I think it is true that we have not provided strong enough incentives. There are proposals now to substantially increase the exemptions for children in the federal income tax. Mm-hmm. There are individuals like Gordon Berlin and Ron Haskins who have promoted, as well as myself, a major revision in the earned income tax credit that would make both mother and father in a family eligible for EITC based on their own income, rather than combining that and then thereby making them ineligible for the EITC. We could do a guaranteed health insurance coverage for every married couple and their children, and also substantially promote home ownership. Jane, one last thing that's very important on the home ownership side. Only 9% of single mothers own their own home versus 42% of those that are married couple. Mm. If we're going to build a vibrant, dynamic housing market in the country, you cannot build it on a family structure such as we have.
Let me get a couple more calls in here before we end up this hour. Emmy is on the line from Nashville, Tennessee. Emmy, welcome.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I guess I feel like people are making marriage sort of the panacea for as a solution to this problem. And whether someone's married or not, I mean, clearly, like you said, I mean, you know, 50% of new marriages ending in divorce, and bad marriages that stay together, et cetera. But it just seems to me that it's about prevention, that it's about couples and women having children when they want to have them. And there is a tremendous amount of lack of information, misinformation about contraception, and that's why oftentimes people end up pregnant when they don't necessarily want to be, regardless of whether they're married or not.
Emmy, thank you. Sarah McClanahan, I'll let you respond. I feel Emmy's referring to, you know, sex education, lack of access to contraceptives and such. What do you think?
Well, I think there's, you know, some truth to that. But the fact is, a lot of the women who maybe their first child they didn't know about contraception, they've gone on to have more children, and they obviously do know about contraception. I think the more common situation is the one where the woman that we talked to, Lisa, I think, where she was with the guy for 3 years. So she thought she was in a stable relationship. And so she maybe didn't mean to get pregnant, but when she did get pregnant, certainly wasn't going to give the baby up or have an abortion. But then the relationship doesn't last. So I think that it's not just about access to or even information about contraceptions. I think it's a lot more about how we can stabilize these relationships and how we can get both young parents to kind of be ready for marriage. I was really struck by Andrew's comment about the low percentage of single mothers who own their own homes, because when you talk to these unmarried couples, one of the main things they say that's a barrier to getting married, or what they're waiting for, is to be able to have, you know, a nice house and a car. Mm. And they view these kinds of accomplishments as really sort of symbols of being ready for marriage. And I think a lot of people feel reluctant to really make that commitment if they don't have these things.
Andrew Sum, I'll let you have the last word here. What do you, you've studied these numbers, you've compiled these shocking statistics. What do you see now moving forward based on the research that you have done? Where are we headed?
I think we're headed for an unmitigated demographic, economic, and fiscal crisis. If we fail to turn these numbers around in a dramatic way in the near future, there has been no trend favorable in this area now for 40 years. And strengthening the perceptions among young men about the importance of being a father and being responsible for your children is important. Jane, this is the last thing I want to say, but Tim Russert, in one of his talks a few years ago, when he was on Hannity and Combs talking about his book, Big Russ and Me, he said, "It is more important to see a sermon than to hear a sermon." And I think that's what we have more of our young boys and girls to see, is to see that sermon every day with a father in the home.
Andrew Sum, Director of the Center for Labor and Market Studies at Northeastern University. I appreciate your time. Thank you, Professor.
You're welcome.
Sarah McClanahan, sociologist and lead investigator of the Fragile Families and the Well-Being of Children Study at Princeton. Thanks to you.
You're welcome.
And listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.